Natasha, you, I mean, you see that the schedule is very, very busy and tight, so let us start for the first speaker.
Thank you. So I'm actually a little upset that I forgot to give a title, because my forgetting
to give a title may have made people hope that I had something essentially new to say, which isn't the case. I'm only going to be trying to I wanted to tell you a little bit about what it means to do string perturbation theory with super-Riemann surfaces. The reason I want to explain it is that I think it's really the right way to look at the subject, and without it, one really loses the beauty. But I had trouble, I didn't want to get into a lot of technicalities, so I'm only going to be explaining some generalities. And that runs the risk that it will seem like I haven't explained anything. But I wasn't able to think of a solution, so we'll just have to go ahead. So my first goal will be to answer this question. So what is integration on a supermanifold? And what is picture changing? Or at least, what are different pictures? So let's first remember integration on an ordinary manifold. The reason I want to start with an ordinary manifold is that if I don't remind you of the technicality that you probably went through as an undergraduate to learn what it means to integrate on a manifold, then a corresponding definition for a supermanifold will look technical. So I just want to make sure you realize that it's no more technical than the standard case. So we first assume that we know how to integrate a compactly supported form on Rn. So if we have an expression f of x1 up to xn, dx1 up to dxn, and f has compact support, I'll assume we know what's meant by its integral. I'm only going to give this definition that Bott and Tu give in their book. Then if you have a manifold, first of all, what's meant by a manifold is that it's a union over alpha of some open sets, which I call O alpha, or I'll call them U alpha, but I'll try to make that U look different from this one. And the U alpha are all embedded as open sets in Rn in such a way that phi alpha phi beta inverse is an isomorphism where it's defined. So a fancier way to say it is that M is locally isomorphic to an open set in Rn. So I've written down some local isomorphisms, but they're compatible. Meaning, if a small region is part of two different U's, then the structure it gets from the two maps to Rn are supposed to be compatible. Meaning that one map times the inverse of the other is an isomorphism where it's defined. Then the next step is to define a partition of unity. That means we have functions A alpha, which whose support is in U alpha. That means that A alpha vanishes outside U alpha. And also the sum over alpha of A alpha is 1. In that case, if omega is an n form on M, we just define its integral over M as the sum over alpha of the integral of A alpha times omega. Well, where do we integrate A alpha times omega? Well, A alpha is 0 outside of U alpha. So we integrate it over U alpha, which is in Rn. Now, at some point in your studies, you probably learned a definition more or less like that, and then forgot it. And the reason you forgot it is the same reason that you forgot the 19th century definition of a real number. So a real number was an equivalence class of Cauchy sequences, and you learned that at some point, probably. But then you found it was more useful to get used to the fact that real numbers are an intrinsic concept, natural concept, with certain properties. And the properties of real numbers are more useful than remembering the definition. So it's the same here. At some point in your studies, you got used to the fact that manifolds and integration over manifolds were a natural operation. And although you could build it up from more elementary things, the way I said, it's more useful to get familiar with the concept of a manifold and integration on a manifold, and not always try to reduce to first principles. So it's the same with a supermanifold. Now, in the case of a supermanifold, so the local model, well, if you looked in a lot of books, they would say that the local model is Rn slash m, parameterized by real by even variables and odd variables. For most applications in physics in Euclidean signature, and that includes string perturbation theory, this is not quite the right definition. You don't want to claim that the, I put a star here. The star means that the thetas are odd variables, but we don't claim they're real. I should tell you that if we are in Lorentz signature, then we would ask for the thetas to be real. And but if you're going to do, I'm making a statement that has nothing to do with supersymmetry. I regularly encounter a physicist who discovers for the first time that Euclidean fermions are not real and gets upset. It's a fact of life. For example, in the standard model in Euclidean signature, the fermions do not have a real structure. That's because the weak interactions violate parity. So in Lorentz signature, if you take the complex conjugate of a left-handed quark field, you get a right-handed anti-quark or something. But in Euclidean signature, it doesn't work. If you try complex conjugation of Euclidean signature fields, fermion fields in the standard model is not a defined operation. So you have to get used to thinking of variables, odd variables, where you never are allowed to complex conjugate them. You talk about theta, and you never talk about theta bar. And therefore, you have to be a little bit careful also in explaining what you mean in claiming that the t's are real. So in this world, we won't allow ourselves to make reparameterizations such as this. So we have even and odd variables, t and theta. And we let ourselves make reparameterizations that involve adding higher order terms in the thetas. But at least we keep track of the evenness and oddness. So we will only add to t expressions even in the thetas, and we'll only add to theta expressions odd in the thetas. Since we're not going to claim that the thetas are real, we can't really claim that t is real. We only want to claim that t is real modulo the odd variables. So in other words, if we set all the odd variables to zero, we'd be left with a real manifold. But that's the only claim. That's the only reality condition we want. So a surprising number of particle physicists don't realize this, but that's the meaning of Euclidean space path integrals in the standard model. And it's also the way you have to approach string perturbation theory. So instead of writing RNM, I usually write RN star M, where the purpose of the star is just to remind us not to make the mistake of thinking that the odd variables are real.
But why don't
Because you can't. It would be the wrong thing. In the standard model, that would amount to adding a mirror set of fermions that transform oppositely under the... okay.
So there are two different definitions of the supermanifold.
Almost all physical applications in Euclidean signature use the definition I've given you, where there is no claim about reality unless you reduce modulo the odd variables. By contrast, in Lorentz signature, it's natural to ask for the odd variables to be real. So for example, going back to the standard model, if we do a path integral in Lorentz signature, the fermion fields in the standard model are real in Lorentz signature. They're not real in Euclidean signature. So I prefer to say there's one definition, but there's a special case with more properties when you can claim there's a real structure. But for string perturbation theory, the special case isn't useful. The special case happens to be, as your question illustrates, what most people take for granted, but it doesn't work that way, either in string perturbation theory or in the standard model. So you have to think it, I write Rn/m, but the only meaning of the R is that the variables are real if you reduce modulo the nilpotence. If you throw away all the odd variables, that includes both the coordinates and possibly the moduli, if there are odd moduli. Now, a supermanifold, now I'm going to say the same thing though. I'm going to leave out a lot of steps that would be there in a careful definition and just give you a flavor. But a supermanifold M is covered by open sets where each U alpha is embedded in Rn star M and phi alpha phi beta inverse is an isomorphism where it's defined. So an isomorphism is something like this. I want to stress that the reparametrizations don't preserve any real structure. So for example, T might go to T plus I times theta 1, theta 2. And you wouldn't be able to get rid of the I by redefining the thetas. In general, there might be many thetas. T goes to T plus G alpha beta of T, theta alpha, theta beta. And no change of basis of the thetas will make the complex valued functions G alpha beta real. Anyway, that's the world we're working in when we talk about supermanifolds. So a supermanifold is locally isomorphic to an open set in Rn star n. And if we're going to define integration on a supermanifold, we have to first define integration on Rn star m. But I believe you all probably know how to define integration on Rn star m. So, well, we'll discuss more carefully what's meant by volume form in a moment. But first I'm going to write it down uncritically. So a volume form, informally at least, is a function of the t's and thetas times a top form, dt1 up to d theta m. We'll discuss later what kind of object that is more critically. But so I think you all know the definition of integration for such a thing. But just to remind you, f can be expanded in a power series in the thetas and that power series will have a top term. The top term is proportional to the product of all the thetas. And integration, the definition of integration, we're going to assume that the definition of integration for a compactly supported volume form on Rn slash m is ordinary integration of the top component. You pick out the top component and integrate it in the usual sense. So this is the Berezin integral, and you're probably familiar with at least that much of integration on supermanifolds. So to go from there to integration on a general supermanifold, we just imitate the definition in the bosonic case. So in the we pick a partition of unity. It means the same thing it does before. The sum of A alpha is 1, and A alpha is 0 outside U alpha. And then we if we're given a volume form, we define the integral to be the sum over alpha of the integral over U alpha of A alpha times omega. The point is that A alpha times omega can be thought of as a form on Rn star m, because it's 0 outside U alpha, which is embedded in Rn star m. So we only have to know how to integrate on Rn star m. So there's something which I think is really funny about string perturbation theory, which is that supergravity was developed starting in the 70s. And even if people working in supergravity didn't formalize all the things exactly the way I'm telling you, integration and also integration by parts on supermanifolds were certainly quite familiar to people working in supergravity. Otherwise, you can't really do supergravity. But I think it wasn't properly incorporated in the 80s in string perturbation theory. So one thing I want to say, we made use of the Berezin integral at this point, but maybe I should just remind you, just to make a point, that the basic Berezin integral is captured by these statements. The reason that we don't need a real structure for the thetas, for the odd variables, is that this is a purely algebraic definition. So there's no need to claim that theta is real, and there's no need to have such a thing as theta bar as part of the formalism. So the Berezin integral and its elaboration that we used in defining integration on a supermanifold is a purely algebraic operation. Yes, I knew there was an eraser somewhere. Okay. Now, to get anywhere, we actually want to also know about integration by parts. And of course, as I said, people in supergravity knew how to integrate by parts. But I can't find any papers before the 1990s by Belopolsky where integration by parts on a supermanifold was formulated as part of string perturbation theory. On supermoduli space, at least. So we're going to have to take a more careful look at what's meant by a volume form. So we need a version of Stokes' theorem. And for this, we have to discuss forms. So first, let's go back to an ordinary manifold. So what I'm going to explain in a moment is that on an ordinary manifold, there's only one kind of form. But on a supermanifold, there are different pictures that are possible for forms. And that's the root of the picture-changing phenomenon in superstring theory. So on an ordinary manifold, M, let's say with local coordinates xi, well, a form is something like f of x times dx I1 up to dx ik. Where k is no bigger than n. So if you like, a form is a function f of x and dx. So for every xi, there's a corresponding opposite statistics variable dxi. And a form is a function of x and dx. Now, we don't have to discuss what kind of functions of dx we want, because the dx's are odd variables. And the only functions of odd variables that make any sense are polynomial functions. So f is polynomial in dx. Because there's nothing else it can be, because the dx's are fermionic variables. Now, so on forms, their natural operations, one is to multiply by dx that arises when we take a wedge product of forms. But there's also differentiation with respect to dx. That's contraction with a vector field. If you want to discuss symmetries acting on forms, you need Lie derivatives. And to define Lie derivatives, you need contraction. So contraction means differentiation with respect to dx. It removes one of the indices from a form. So that's an important operation. And of course, another important operation is the exterior derivative. The exterior derivative is the sum of dxi times d by dxi. And it obeys d squared equals 0. And it also enters in Stokes's law, Stokes's theorem. Stokes' theorem says that if the dimension of M is K, or N, let's say, and omega equals an N form, but omega is D of chi, let's say, maybe M has a boundary, Stokes' theorem says that then the integral of omega over M, well, this isn't the theorem, this is just a statement that omega is d chi. The theorem is the next statement, that the integral of d chi over m is the integral over the boundary of chi. So we need an analog, well, in supergravity, people need an analog of that, because otherwise it doesn't make sense to have a Lagrangian written in superspace and vary it to get equations of motion. You have to be able to integrate by parts. In string perturbation theory, we need a version of that, because it's the essential point in proving gauge invariance. So let's try to see what we would have to do. So we go back to our supermanifold, with both even coordinates t1 up to tn and odd coordinates theta 1 up to theta m. And now if we're going to introduce forms, we need to introduce for every even or odd coordinate a corresponding differential, dti or d theta j. And these are supposed, these will have opposite statistics to the corresponding functions. So this guy will be odd, and this guy will be even. And now a form, well, it's hard to find a convenient notation, but a form will be a function of the t's and thetas, and also of the dt's and d thetas. But the trick comes when we ask what class of functions we want to consider. Well, obviously it's going to be polynomials in dt. But what about d theta? Since the dt's are odd variables, polynomials are all we've got. But since the d theta's are even variables, we have a lot of choices. For example, we could consider polynomials in d theta. Or we could consider L2 functions of theta, square integrable functions. Or we could do something else. So first, let's consider polynomial functions. If we take polynomial functions of d theta, we get differential forms. So differential forms make sense on a supermanifold. So for example, a one form with the f of t theta dt plus g of t theta d theta. Where, well, I think I'm, sorry. If, so for example, I could take f to be even and nu to be odd. And then that's a one form of definite statistics. Now, differential forms are perfectly good, but the only trouble is, with them is that they can only be integrated on purely bosonic subspaces. That would be obvious if I'd given you a definition of integration of a differential form that I unfortunately forgot to give. So, you see, it's convenient to reformulate what's meant by that integral as follows. First, we think of the differential form as a function f of x and dx. And then we say the following. There's no natural measure for integration over a real variable x, but if you're given a pair consisting of a real variable x and a corresponding fermionic variable dx, there's a natural measure for the pair. Because if you rescale x, the integration measure for dx would scale in the opposite way. So this integral can be thought of as the integral of the corresponding function of x and dx with respect to the natural measure. Where this is just a Bayesian integral, the same kind of integral I've been telling you about, over x and dx. So what does it mean concretely? When you integrate over dx, you use the fact that the integral of dx of 1 is 0. The integral over dx. the integral over the odd variable dx of 1 is 0, and the integral over the odd variable dx of dx is 1. So if we're integrating over a lot of variables x's and the corresponding differentials dx's, that'll pick out an f of x dx, the term that has all the dx's present, and it will appear with a coefficient 1. That'll be the top form part. And then we'll go on and integrate it over x. So that's a way to describe what we're trying to adapt to supermanifolds. But now you can see it's not going to work. So I think we're going to practice. See, okay. So for simplicity, suppose we had odd variables. Well, really, the basic point could be illustrated if we just have one odd variable theta only. Then a differential form, a form with the function f of theta and d theta. Theta is odd and d theta is even. And now we want to integrate it over the pair theta d theta. So the integral over theta will tell us to pick out the top part, the part that does have theta present. But the integral over d theta is just an integral over what naively is a real variable, except I've told you it isn't real. But just to orient yourself, if it were a real variable, you can only do that integral if it converges. And you certainly can't integrate a polynomial function. So a differential form is, by definition, polynomial in the d thetas, and that means it can't be integrated over the d thetas. This is an incredibly elementary point, which I think I've said in an incredibly confusing way. And the main reason that happened is that I forgot to explain this at the right point, and then I interjected it in a rushed way. So we can't integrate a differential form over odd variables, but we can integrate them over purely bosonic submanifolds. So let's just do that before we move on and figure out what we can integrate on a supermanifold. So for example, in the case of dimension 1/1, so a form with the f of t theta, dt, and d theta, which might be, for example, let's write a 1 form. A 1 form with the a of t and theta, dt, plus b of t and theta, d theta. So we can't integrate that over the supermanifold because the integral over d theta can't possibly converge. But so as I've written it, we're on R1*1. But let S in R1*1 be a submanifold of dimension 1/0. Then, as I'll show you in a second, so in the bosonic world, you integrate one forms over one manifolds all the time. So if you're given a submanifold of dimension 1/0, that's a purely even manifold of dimension 1, restricting a one form to it, you'll get an ordinary one form that you should be able to integrate. And concretely, for example, S could be defined by theta equals nu of t, where nu is a function with odd coefficients. And then f restricted to s is a of t, nu of t, dt, plus b of t, nu of t, times d theta would be d nu dt times dt. So f restricted to s is an ordinary one form that you can certainly integrate. So in general, you can do something with differential forms on a supermanifold. Namely, a k form can be integrated over a purely even submanifold of dimension k. However, if you want to be able to integrate over a submanifold that isn't purely even, that means you will be integrating over some thetas and also the corresponding d thetas. And therefore, you'd better have a class of functions that can be integrated over the d thetas. So We say that f of t theta, dt and d theta has picture number minus k if it is localized with respect to k of the d thetas. So there are different ways you could set the theory up. Localized could mean simply that the integral over k d thetas converges. So for example, a Gaussian function would be okay. It can be integrated. But it's usually convenient. So localized could mean just L2, or more general, at least convergent, or rapid decay at infinity. So there might be many d thetas, and you could consider a form with polynomial growth in some directions, but rapid decay in others. If there's rapid decay in k directions, we say that the form has picture number minus k. But in string perturbation theory, it's usually more useful to consider delta function support at d theta equals 0. So then the picture number is minus the number of d thetas with respect to which there's delta function support. The minus sign is inconvenient, but unfortunately it follows from standard conventions in string perturbation theory. Now, there's a special case of this that's most important. So, okay. Well, okay. The most important case is an integral form where k is the fermion, the odd dimension. So we have localization with respect to all d thetas. That means that the form as a function of the d thetas has compact support, or at least it has rapid decay at infinity. But in string perturbation theory, it's actually convenient to simply say that the form has distributional support at the origin. So that, in any case, ensures that the integral over all d thetas converges. So now, if we have a function of t theta and dt and d theta, which is a form, we can integrate it over all variables . The integration is simply an ordinary integral over the even variables t and d theta, and a Bayesian integral over the odd variables dt and theta. So you see that the picture number equals minus the number of odd directions over which we integrate. That's a tautology. If we're planning to integrate over the d theta, we have to integrate something that converges. And it only will converge if the form is localized, either with delta function support or rapid decay, with respect to all the d thetas. Otherwise, we won't have a convergent integral. So the only integrals we can do on a supermanifold will be integrals where the picture number is equal to minus the odd dimension. Again, the minus sign is a nuisance that comes from standard conventions.
Could you imagine having it being localized on like a linear subspace or a curved subspace?
Well, it's hard for me to say the most general thing you might ever be interested in doing. But in string perturbation theory, The most important case is an integral form that's completely localized. But, and the other case that you will run into is the case where, with respect to some decomposition, you have a differential form in some direction, polynomial in some direction, and rapid decay in other directions. So I've personally never needed anything more general, but you can find in literature papers where people discuss more general things, and maybe they're useful for some applications. Any other questions?
So if I add two forms of picture number k, we could get form of picture number k minus 1.
It goes in the opposite direction, I think. If you have two forms that don't decay rapidly, their sum might decay more rapidly. So by this definition, in practice, though, usually we have delta functions as a function of some d thetas and polynomials as a function of the others. So I've stated this so broadly that there can be cancellations when you add forms. But usually we don't do that. Now, the formalism I've introduced might sound a little bit redundant if you've followed what I said so far. And I'm worried you haven't, because I was clumsy in the way I introduced this part. But the purpose it has is that you can now readily state Stokes' theorem. You can state it so readily that I think I won't erase the bosonic version. We'll just repeat it in a second. So first I want to say that the class of forms should be closed under natural operations. And what are the natural operations I told you here? Multiplication by dx, differentiation with respect to dx, and also the exterior derivative. So we want a class of forms that's closed under multiplication by d theta. So also, or by differentiation with respect to d theta. And it will follow that, therefore, you can act with the exterior derivative, which is just multiplication times differentiation with respect to one of the thetas. So to be able to define standard operations of differential geometry, we need this. But what are the two most obvious classes of functions that do the job? One are the polynomials. They certainly are closed under multiplication and differentiation. But the opposite picture from polynomials are the delta functions. There's one more condition I want to state in a second. So we can have delta of d theta, delta prime of d theta. So this is another class of functions that's invariant under these operations. But I forgot one more important operation. One more important operation is scaling. Dx goes to t dx, d theta goes to t d theta. That's important because a form of in the bosonic world, a form of definite degree is a form that transforms with definite degree under scaling. And we want to preserve that here. So we could call this, so if f goes to t to the k times f, we say that f has ghost number or degree k. So so to define that, our class of functions has to be invariant under scaling. That's why we take delta functions of d theta equals 0, not at d theta equals 1. Delta functions at d theta equals 1 wouldn't be invariant under scaling. So in general, if I have a form f of t theta and d theta, it has a degree, and it also has a picture number. And f can be integrated on a submanifold of dimension p slash q only if the degree is P minus Q, and the picture number is minus Q. So the example I gave you before, the picture number was 0. We could integrate a P form of picture number 0 on a purely bosonic submanifold of dimension P. But if you want to integrate over Q odd variables, the picture number has to be Q, so that Q of the d theta integrals will converge. And then you'll find out that the bosonic part of the integral will be 0 unless the degree is P minus Q. Why did I scale dx and d theta in the same way? I had to, because I wanted the exterior derivative to have a definite degree. Or if you like, I wanted the definition of the degree to be invariant under coordinate transformations that mix x and theta. That forces dx and d theta to have the same degree. So this statement might sound slightly Delphic, so I want to give you a typical example that we can integrate. So let's be on R1 star 1, and suppose we want to integrate on all of m. According to what I've said here, the degree will be 0 and the picture number will be minus 1. So let's write a form with that property. It'll be e to the minus t squared, for example, times dt times delta of d theta. That's a good one because obviously, it's times theta. Obviously, that could be integrated over theta, d theta, t, and dt. So the integral over theta will kill the theta. The integral over d theta will annihilate the delta function. And the purely bosonic integral is just a Gaussian integral that converges. So this is a well-defined non-zero integral. And you see, what we integrated had picture number minus 1 because it was localized with respect to 1 d theta. And it has degree 0 because delta of d theta has degree minus 1. Any questions there? There's one interesting detail I want to point out, which is that when we set up this theory, we need the following. You're probably comfortable with that assertion, but you might become slightly less comfortable or at least confused if I remind you that we're not allowed to claim that d theta is real, because we weren't allowed to claim that theta was real. So d theta is an even variable, but it wouldn't make sense to claim it was real. So this is a purely algebraic statement. Analogous to the Berezin integral. Thank you. No, sorry, delta n 0 was correct.
Sorry.
I should have told you what I meant by the rotation. Delta n is meant to be the nth derivative of a delta function. Why am I talking about the nth derivative of a delta function? Because a natural class of functions that obeys our conditions are actually distributions with support at d theta equals 0. A basis of such distributions is given by delta of d theta and its derivatives. So when we integrate in general, what we will have to integrate is a derivative of d theta. And the way we integrate it is by using this fact. But that fact is more a definition than a fact. It's a definition analogous to the Berezin integral. Because d theta is an even integral. D theta is an even variable, but it's not real. or we're not allowed to claim that it's real because at farther back we weren't allowed to claim that theta was real. Just as the Euclidean space fermions in the Standard Model, we can't claim that they're real. So definite integration over an even variable that isn't real can't be literally understood as an integral in the conventional sense. It's more like an algebraic definition. Now, the fact that we need this here is analogous to what happens in the beta gamma path integral. What led to the perplexity in the 80s that unfortunately led the subject not to be developed in terms of super-Riemann surfaces is that people had trouble understanding the beta gamma path integral, where beta and gamma are the superconformal ghosts. Beta and gamma are even variables that we can't claim are real. And the integral over beta and gamma has to be understood in an algebraic sense, analogous to a Berezin integral. So what I've given you here is the most elementary reason that in supermanifold theory, we need to make such formal definitions. I'm going to write one more formula to help convince you that this is a formal operation. We actually more generally need this integral. And you see, that would not be true if d theta were a real variable. Then there would be an absolute value on the right-hand side. So in this world, there's an analog of the Berezin integral for certain even variables, namely the d thetas. And it's perfectly in parallel to the way you have to treat the beta and gamma superconformal ghosts. Any questions?
What you put in the box, you can derive from the everyday definition.
What did you say?
What you put in the box.
Yes.
Something you can derive.
Well, you basically have to postulate it in setting up the formalism. But I didn't explain precisely why you have to postulate it. You have to postulate it because you want the formalism to be invariant under reparametrizations of the t's and thetas, which induce in an obvious way reparametrizations of the dt's and the d thetas. And then for reparametrization invariance, you will need this. It's analogous to the Berezin integral with no absolute value of lambda. So this is a bosonic analog of the Berezin integral. Any other questions? So now let's just write down Stokes' theorem. So now M is a supermanifold of dimension n slash m. And omega is an n slash m form, by which I mean it has degree, n minus m, and picture number minus m. And it's omega is equal to d chi. And then Stokes' theorem says the same thing it does in the bosonic world. And as I've told you, even if it's not formalized this way, people in the 70s and early 80s were certainly using this in supergravity, although it wasn't really used in string perturbation theory before Bielopolsky. So, if you wanted to prove it, you would do the following. So I told you what was the definition of the integral of omega over m, and that involved reducing to the case of Rn star m with a compactly supported form. So you would only need to prove this on Rn star m. And if you unwind the definitions, you would then find that this follows from the ordinary Stokes theorem on Rn after integrating over the odd variables. So you can prove it by reducing to the bosonic world. But it's more useful to have the statement in the supercase. It's a little bit like the fact that since a real number is a Dedekind cut of rationals, you could reduce any statement about real numbers to a statement about rationals. But it's ultimately better to become comfortable with real numbers. So you will find much simpler statements follow from this formulation, even though you could prove it by reducing to the bosonic case. Now, I don't want to write out the I told you roughly how to prove it, but I don't want to write that out in detail. I think it would be more useful if I just verify it, show you what it means concretely for R0 star 1. So on R0 star 1, I want to introduce some terminology, though. On a supermanifold of dimension n slash m, an nm form is called an integral form. Well, a pm, p sub m form. And, well, an nm form is what you can integrate. So that's called an integral form. The terminology I really want to introduce is integral forms as opposed to differential forms. So remember, half an hour ago or so, we mentioned that if we took polynomial functions of the d thetas, we would have differential forms. And differential forms are good for some things, but we can't integrate them over odd variables. The opposite of a differential form is an integral form. It can be integrated. And that's because it's localized with respect to the d thetas. Integral forms are like differential forms in the sense that they represent the same algebraic operations, which were d theta, d by d theta, and scaling. So the same algebra acts on them, but it acts on them in a different picture. So the relation between integral forms and differential forms is the most elementary version of the notion of different pictures in superstring perturbation theory. So, well, the thing you can integrate, though, is an integral form of top degree. An n minus k slash m form, well, I'll call it a codimension k. So, I think I need to explain the top degree bit. So, suppose we're in dimension n slash m. What would be meant by an integral form of top degree? Well, the dt's have degree 1, so we want all the dt's, but we can't have more than n of them. We have to localize with respect to the d thetas, so we need, well, we could have m delta functions. And then that would have degree n minus m. So that would have degree n minus m. That's the highest degree we can have, because all we could do otherwise is to leave out a dt. That reduces the degree by 1. Or we could replace delta of d theta by a derivative of delta of d theta. But delta of d theta already has degree minus 1, and its derivatives have more negative degree. So the basic polynomial in the dt's times a delta function in the d thetas has the highest degree for an integral form. So for a differential form, there's a lowest degree, which is 0, and then you can go up. For an integral form, there's a highest degree, and from there you can go down. So what you can integrate on a supermanifold is an integral form of top degree. That's analogous to the fact that on an ordinary manifold, you can integrate a differential form of top degree. The only difference is that on an ordinary manifold, the same object's differential forms have both top degrees and bottom degrees. On a supermanifold, there are differential forms which have a bottom degree but no top degree, and there are integral forms which have a top degree and no bottom degree, and there are intermediate pictures where you represent the same algebraic relations with objects that have neither top degree nor bottom degree. Those can be integrated on suitable submanifolds, but not on a purely bosonic submanifold, and also not in the whole space. So, going back to Stokes's theorem, if m has degree n slash m, what we can integrate is an integral form of top degree. And if it's going to be d of something, chi will be an integral form of codimension 1. And Stokes' theorem will say the same thing it does in the bosonic world, except that a slightly more careful discussion is needed of what's meant by the boundary of M. I won't explain that right now. If you want, in the discussion period, we can talk about it. But instead of, so I told you roughly that Stokes' theorem can be reduced to the bosonic version of Stokes' theorem by remembering how we defined the integral over M in the first place. But instead of being more careful with that, I wanted to show you the example of R0 star 1. So a codimension 1 integral form will be chi is f of theta times delta prime of d theta. So codimension 0 would have been just f of theta times delta of d theta. We get codimension 1 by replacing delta of d theta by delta prime of d theta. So let's verify that the integral of d chi over r0 star 1 is 0. Well, what is d chi? Well, d chi is d theta times d by d theta of f of theta delta prime of d theta. And we have to now say that d theta times delta prime of d theta is minus delta of d theta. So that would be true for ordinary delta functions. And here, well, if we had set up more carefully our bosonic analog of the Berezin integral, this would have been part of a property we either would have proved or assumed. So we've got a simple delta function of d theta, so now we can try to integrate it. But we're supposed to get 0. It's supposed to be the integral over theta and d theta of what? Of df d theta times delta of d theta with a minus sign. So we can integrate over d theta with the help of the delta function. But the integral of df d theta is 0 according to the Berezin integral, because df d theta has no theta. This fact is what made Berezin define his integral the way he did. Yes?
You say you want to define the end, but can you, is the idea that the boundary of the fermionic direction, the fermionic directions do not have any boundaries?
The fermionic directions don't have boundaries, but I don't want to, we'll say that now, but I won't give a complete explanation right now. The fermionic directions you should think of as being compact. Where there are some subtleties explaining what you mean by the boundary in the bosonic directions. In the 80s, that was called the ambiguity of superstring perturbation theory. Now, what is this formalism supposed to have to do with superstring perturbation theory? Well, unfortunately, we're not going to have too much time to say too much. But in superstring perturbation theory, we consider what's actually a super-Riemann surface with superconformal vertex operators. And the claim is that the integral over all the world sheet fields of the exponential of minus the action times all these vertex operators is naturally understood as a top degree integral form on supermoduli space. We have to be informal for the moment because I haven't even told you what a super-Riemann surface is. But the claim is that after we properly introduce super-Riemann surfaces and all that, the world sheet path integral naturally produces a top degree integral form on supermoduli space. So it can be integrated on supermoduli space. So first of all, the natural definition of the genus J contribution to an amplitude is just the integral over the appropriate supermoduli space, which depends on the numbers and types of punctures of this form. That's the natural definition, which is conceptually as simple as the corresponding definition for the bosonic string. If one prefers to work in the bosonic world, one can give a corresponding definition in the bosonic world. And in fact, Ashok Sen and I wrote a recent paper where he explains in detail how to do it. The definition is, I would say, a little bit too long and convoluted to be a fundamental definition. Here, the definition is conceptually as simple as for the bosonic string. However, I've hidden the details. So I haven't even explained a super-Riemann surface, and then I should what a super-Riemann surface is, and then I should explain this statement. I'm not sure precisely how far we'll get, but we'll do as much of that as we can. But anyway, the point that I want to make is that the goal of this formalism is to get simple definitions. But they're simple definitions when it's analogous to learning about the real numbers. The definitions are simple if expressed in terms of not the rational number. We could do calculus with rational numbers, but it would be clumsy. It's better to become comfortable with real numbers before trying to do calculus. Now, in this language, what is gauge invariance? Gauge invariance is the following statement. If one of the V's, for example, V1, is gotten by applying the BRST operator to some other superconformal vertex operator W, then the corresponding integral form is D of a codimension 1 form. So people who have studied the bosonic string are familiar with this kind of statement for the bosonic string. As far as I can see, nobody wrote a formula like that for the for superstrings before Bélopolsky in the 90s, and his papers were very little studied. So gauge invariance follows from Stokes' theorem. Gauge invariance says that if this is true, the amplitude should vanish. So under that hypothesis, Stokes' theorem says under that hypothesis, the amplitude reduces to an integral over the boundary of moduli space, which in the context of moduli space really means the divisor is at infinity where you compactify it. And, well, that equal sign, the statement that that equals zero, what it really means is that after investigating the behavior at infinity, in those theories where gauge invariance is true, you prove that the behavior at infinity is such that the boundary contributions vanish. So I'd like to explain space-time supersymmetry in a similar framework. So very crudely, space-time supersymmetry is roughly the same with W replaced by the spin operator of Friedan, Martinek, and Schenker. But it takes a few more steps to explain that properly, so we won't at the moment. Any questions here? So the goal would be to explain, first of all, what's a super Riemann surface so that you could at least have hope to understand what's the moduli space of super Riemann surfaces. And then why would I claim that the world sheet path integral generates a top degree integral form on super moduli space? So it's going to be hard to do all of that, but I might say I wrote up the most careful explanations I could in my paper on superstring perturbation theory revisited. So if any of you are actually inspired to be interested, you could look at that paper. It's going to be very hard to give complete explanations today, but I'll try to say a few words. So first, what is a super Riemann surface? Well, one statement I want to make is that super Riemann surfaces are much simpler to understand, much simpler to describe, if formulated in terms of complex geometry rather than in terms of supergravity, because supergravity tends to introduce a lot of variables. Well, okay. You have to work harder, I think, to get to the essential point. So I'm going to approach it just as a complex manifold of dimension 1/1. So locally, it has an even and odd coordinate z and theta. So, but you're allowed to make reparametrizations that mix z and theta. But if all we have is a complex supermanifold of dimension 1/1, that's not a super Riemann surface, or at least it's not a super Riemann surface with n equals 1 supersymmetry. What would be its local symmetries? Well, we could do f of z d by dz. And we could do alpha of z d by d theta. And we could do beta of z times theta d by dz. And we could do h of z times theta d by d theta. So a general vector field on a 1-1 supermanifold could be written in terms of two even and two odd functions of z. They're obviously going to generate a Lie superalgebra because the commutator of two vector fields will have to be a vector field. And it's obviously not the usual superconformal algebra, which has one even function and one odd function. But it would surprise me if a lot of you would know what the superalgebra is without giving it some very careful thought. The superalgebra that they generate is actually the n equals 2 superconformal algebra. So it's elementary, but will look a little bit miraculous if you just start with those expressions, calculate commutators, and you'll find after a little while that you have rediscovered the n equals 2 superconformal algebra. But something that will make it more palatable is the following. In a theory with n equals 2 supersymmetry in two dimensions, so it could have lived on a world with one even and two odd coordinates. I've called the odd coordinates, I'll call them theta and theta prime. Okay, theta and theta tilde. Not theta and theta bar, because we can't sensibly claim that one is the complex conjugate of the other, unless we make z real, and then we would be in Lorentz signature. In Euclidean signature, we would say there's one even and two odd coordinates. You could have a non-chiral superfield that would be a function of all those. But you can also have a chiral superfield, which would just be a function of z and 1 theta. Or an anti-chiral superfield that would be a function of z and a different theta. And the realization of the n equals 2 algebra on a chiral superfield is actually by these vector fields. You can see it must be, because you know that the n equals 2 superconformal algebra can act on a chiral superfield. And since the chiral superfield is just a function of z and theta, the n equals 2 algebra has to be generated by some vector fields acting on z and theta. And if you write down all the possible vector fields, you'll see there's barely enough to be the n equals 2 algebra. So it must be the n equals 2 algebra. Something which you can check by hand if you're at all skeptical. So if we were doing n equals 2 superstrings, possibly we could work on a general 1-1 complex supermanifold, although, well, I'm not sure if that would work well or not. But we want to, today, discuss conventional superstrings. So we want the n equals 1 superconformal algebra. So that means we want to impose an additional structure that only allows us to make half of the, to use half of these vector fields. Well, if you know what, one way you could approach it, and this is more or less what was said by Friedan. So one definition of super Riemann surfaces was given by Friedan, who said, well, in effect, I'm paraphrasing. He said, we know what are the vector fields we want to use that generate the n equals 1 algebra. And locally, a super Riemann surface has coordinates z and theta, and the symmetries we're allowed to make are the ones on the favored list that generate n equals 1. And then we'll glue together pieces by superconformal transformations. So Friedan gave that definition, but during the same period, others gave a slightly different definition, which I'll tell you, which I think it's more explicit, because it tells you, not just by hand, what vector fields we want to keep, but it gives you a geometrical structure that's only preserved by those vector fields. So you're given, so this is in the absence of Riemann punctures. You're given an odd subbundle D of the tangent bundle. So sigma is a complex submanifold dimension 1/1. So its tangent bundle has rank 1/1, meaning locally it has a basis given by dz and d theta. That would be a general 1-1 supermanifold. A super Riemann surface is given a distinguished subbundle of rank 0/1. And it can be characterized by either of two equivalent properties. You say either of these two things. So if you like coordinates, you say that locally there exist coordinates z and theta such that d is generated by d by d theta plus theta d by dz. If you're familiar with the way supersymmetric Lagrangians are constructed, you know that this operator is often used because it commutes with Wolschmidt supersymmetry. So the structure we have to be given is the operator that commutes with Wolschmidt supersymmetry. However, if we want to be superconformal, we don't give that operator on a nose. We only give the line bundle it generates. So D is generated by this, but it would also be generated by any f of z and theta times d theta plus theta dz. The alternative definition is that d is completely unintegrable. So, well, what does integrable or unintegrable mean? Suppose that locally S is a section of D. Gamma of D is the space of sections of D. Suppose we're given a section. So we have some, okay. In definition one, we're told that there are distinguished coordinates where D looks like this. In definition two, we don't have distinguished coordinates, so we use random coordinates, W and psi. And any section, I'm just trying to be concrete, so a section is going to be A of W d psi plus B of W dw, where A is even and B is odd, nu is odd. Sorry. D has rank 0/1, so D is purely odd. So we take an odd section of D, so that means that A will be even and nu is odd. And if we have such a section, so in general, vector fields form a Lie algebra, or in a supermanifold, they form a super Lie algebra. So if you have any subbundle of the tangent bundle of an ordinary manifold, you can take their commutators, generate new vector fields, and the subbundle is called integrable if you don't get anything new that way. But in the bosonic world, if we're given a one-dimensional subbundle, we don't get anywhere with commutators because you can't commute a bosonic guy with itself. But in the super world, we can take S bracket S, which has stuff like A of W d psi nu of W times dW plus more. It's not trivially zero, and it's even. So complete integrability means that S bracket S is always linearly independent from S. Integrability, well, integrability would mean that S bracket S is some function times S. So complete integrability is the opposite. It says that S and S bracket S are everywhere linearly independent. So the more elegant definition of a super-Riemann surface is that it's a 1-1 supermanifold with a 0/1 subbundle of the tangent bundle that's everywhere completely unintegrable, meaning that if S is any non-zero section locally, it's a purely local statement, you're given any local non-zero section, and then S and S bracket S are linearly independent. Now, it's elementary to prove that these two definitions are equivalent. In one direction, given complete integrability, you can find coordinates z and theta so that d has a section of this kind. It's elementary, but I won't prove it on the blackboard. But I will check the even more trivial opposite direction. We'll just show that 1 implies 2. Well, so we start with, we want to check whether S and S bracket S are linearly independent. But in fact, S bracket S is 2dz. So S and S bracket S are clearly linearly independent because S has a non-zero coefficient of d theta. And S bracket S doesn't contribute to d theta, but it has an everywhere non-zero coefficient of dz. So the tangent bundle fits in an exact sequence. The fancy way to say that is the following. Sigma has a tangent bundle, T sigma, that's generated by the odd subbundle D. And the quotient is isomorphic to D squared. That last statement just means that the quotient is generated by S bracket S. I told you that S bracket S was linearly independent of S. So the tangent bundle mod S, mod functions times S, but functions times S is the same as D, is multiples of S squared. But S is a section of D, so S bracket S is a section of D squared. And multiples of S bracket S generate the tangent bundle mod S. So this is the fancy version of that. Now, what's good about super-Riemann surfaces other than the fact that you can do string theory on them? Well, they behave much more like bosonic Riemann surfaces than like a 1-1 supermanifold would behave. So super Riemann surfaces are much more like ordinary Riemann surfaces. So this double arrow means much more like it's an informal statement. So many ideas from ordinary Riemann surfaces have close analogs for super Riemann surfaces, much more than would be the case if we used the n equals 2 superconformal algebra and didn't impose this superconformal structure. But it actually takes some experience to get used to that statement. And I have to find a way to give you a hint about it in 1 minute. So I wrote down a couple of things in my notes, but I'm only going to tell you the simplest. The most obvious is that on an ordinary Riemann surface, a vertex operator is inserted at a point. But a point is equal to a divisor. On a super Riemann surface, an inverse Schwarz vertex operator. So there's a subtlety about Riemann vertex operators. The story is different, and unfortunately, we don't really have time. But an inverse Schwarz vertex operator is inserted at a point, but a point is not equal to a divisor. A point is not equal to a divisor because we're in dimension 1/1. By divisor, I always mean a submanifold of codimension 1/0. So on a 1-1 supermanifold, a divisor would be a submanifold of dimension 0/1, not a point. So on a generic 1-1 supermanifold, the point at which we insert an inverse Schwarz operator would not correspond to a divisor. But on a super Riemann surface, there's a natural correspondence between points and minimal divisors. The correspondence goes as follows. You start at a point. The tangent bundle has a distinguished odd subbundle D. You go in the D direction. But you can't go very far because the D direction is fermionic. So on an ordinary manifold, if I told you to start at a point and go in a defined direction, you wouldn't know, unless you're given a metric, you wouldn't know how to construct a geodesic or any preferred path. In second order, you wouldn't know what to do. But if you're going in a fermionic direction, you don't have to go anywhere in second order because theta squared is 0. So on a super Riemann surface, unlike a general 1-1 supermanifold, points naturally correspond to divisors. And that's part of why inverse Schwarz vertex operator insertions can behave similarly to vertex operator insertions in bosonic string theories, which are always inserted on divisors. I'm going to make it explicit. So suppose we start at z equals z0 and theta equals theta0. And we go in the s direction. That means we act with the exponential of alpha s, where alpha is an odd parameter. And you see, this is 1 plus alpha s. S squared isn't 0, but alpha squared is 0. So despite non-integrability, we can make sense of this operation of exponentiating s. So that means 1 plus alpha s acts as, so we're trying to act with alpha times d theta plus theta dz. So that means delta theta is alpha, and delta z is alpha theta. So if you start at z equals z0, theta equals theta0, and do this, you end at z equals z0 plus alpha theta0, theta equals theta0 plus alpha. So that's the divisor that corresponds to this point on a superriemann surface. And if I'd asked you what should be called a minimal, this ought to be called a minimal divisor on a superriemann surface. If you think about it a little bit, this type of divisor is the analog of a point on an ordinary Riemann surface. It can't be decomposed into subdivisors, effective positive subdivisors. So this is a minimal divisor. So what I've explained is that a point at which an inverse Schwarz vertex operator would be inserted corresponds in a natural way to a minimal divisor, somewhat analogous to the fact that in the bosonic world, a point on a Riemann surface simply is a divisor. But I think we'll stop here. Thank you. Well, I didn't tell you the right definition in the presence of a Riemann divisor. And I don't think it's a good idea to do it in a rushed way right now.
Can you say anything about a connection between picture changing and multiply space?
Well, I told you the root of the picture changing phenomenon in ordinary integration. But then to explain how it appears in string perturbation theory is, again, something I'd prefer not to do in a rushed way. I'm going to see if I can say anything in 10 seconds. I think the most natural way, if you want to know why pictures appear, they appear inevitably whenever you're integrating on supermanifolds, as I've explained. But if you want to know why a formulation in different pictures appear, the most elementary way to do that involves talking about Riemann vertex operators and Riemann divisors. And it kind of should follow the answer to the previous question. I think I can't do it now, I'm sorry.
Can you say anything about GSO protection from the worldship point of view?
Well, if I had had another 5 minutes to further explain the analogy between super-Riemann surfaces. I told you that super-Riemann surfaces are more like ordinary Riemann surfaces than a generic 1-1 supermanifold would be. So the next thing I would have told you about that after this would have been to explain how gluing works in the inverse Schwarz channel. And then one would have seen that the GSO projection was unavoidable. But I'm not sure how new that would have been, because I think people understood in the 80s, you can't avoid the GSO projection. Integration over moduli space forces you to make a GSO projection. So I would have possibly explained it more elegantly, but people knew that in the 80s. Any other questions? I'm sorry not to be able to answer these questions properly, but none of them are short enough. I want to let you have a coffee break.